Sherry, thank you so much for downloading the 7th episode of the Louder Than Bombs podcast, this time featuring the wonderful Adam Wade, 18-time Moth champion. He's the best. And you know what? I would have to say that the fact that he's so wonderful has motivated me to get this podcast out in time today, because I am not in the mood to do anything other than lie down and hate my life. I've had the worst day. I will share a little bit of it with you, just simply because I feel like venting, and what better place to vent than on my podcast. Those of you who know me or have seen a picture of me know that I have black hair, and people ask me all the time, is it real or do I color it? The reality is that it has been enhanced. And I recently decided that it was time to see what I would look like with just my natural hair color, because I've been coloring my hair since I was probably 18 years old. So I wanted to do it myself. I've got that DIY thing going. And I realized, though, that it was just too much of a project and that I couldn't do it myself. So next best thing, I was like, all right, I'm going to go to a salon, but I don't want to pay like $500 to just go like a shade or two lighter than what I already have on my head. So there are these places where you can go, like beauty schools, where they basically use you as a living guinea pig, or your head rather. And there's one on Spring Street called the Aveda Institute. And, you know, Aveda is supposed to be like a really nice high-end beauty product, and they have these special salons. So I was like, let me go to Aveda. I go there, and I walk in, and this woman, very cheerful, delightful woman, comes up to me, and she's like, I'm Marcy, and I'm going to be, you know, doing your hair color today. And she's like, I've been studying for 7 months, but you're the first live head that I've ever done before, and it's slightly different than when you do it on like a mannequin, because there's heat coming out of your head, and I can't wait to see how that affects the hair color. And I was all like peppy, and I was like, oh, Marcy, I'm so excited to be like your first subject, and let's do this thing, and you know, we're gonna rock it out and all this. So I'm like, you know, it's black right now, and my natural color is like just a shade lighter. It's like a dark chestnut, like a reddish brown. And I was like, you know, do you think you can do that? And she's like, oh yeah, we can do that. And her instructor, like, she has to pass everything by an instructor. Her instructor comes and looks at my head, and she's like, all right, Marcy, you're gonna need to bleach it to red. Bleach to red, which I guess is like where dark hair goes when you start, when you apply bleach to it. And she was like, and then from there, you rinse that out, and then you put on this color and leave that on, and she'll have her natural color from there. And I was like, cool. So Marcy goes, and she mixes up some bleach, and she starts putting it on my head, like applying it to my hair. And, you know, like a few minutes in, she's like, well, that's strange. And I'm like, well, what's the problem? And because you don't want to hear that when someone's working on your hair. And she's like, well, the color's lifting like towards the top, but the bottom is still staying black. And she's like, you know, I'm going to apply some stronger bleach on there. And I'm like, all right, you know, do what you have to do, Marcy. And like, I'm still being supportive and cheerful. She comes back, she puts more bleach on, leaves me there for a while. And then her instructor comes and looks at me, and she's like, Marcy, the bleach is not working. It's not working on her hair. You're going to have to stick a cap on her head and maybe put her under a dryer, or you're going to have to use the 40. And I'm like, what is the 40? I don't even want to know. I still don't know what the 40 is. And Marcy's like terrified. Everyone looks scared. You know, people are like stopping by and like, oh my God, you have to use the 40? Yeah, I have to use the 40 maybe. All this. And I'm like, oh, holy shit. So anyway, she never put my hair in a cap. Eventually, I guess she decided to use the 40. So she takes me to a sink and she applies this shit, and it's like smells just pungent, like pungent death. And I feel like my scalp is going to fall off. and she leaves me there for a long time, and I'm like, God damn it, what's going on here? And she finally comes and rinses it off, and we go back to the station, you know, where she actually does the coloring. And I look at my head, and it's like, I looked like a cheetah. Like, on one single patch of hair, there would be, like, a gradient. Like, at the top, it was, like, almost completely white. And then it would turn, like, a nice little apricot color, and then a tangerine color, and then, you know, a reddish orange, and, you know, and so on. And I was like, this is not correct. This is not the way it's supposed to look. And I'm not an expert, but I still know that this is not the way it's supposed to look. And I called over the instructor and I was like, listen, I'm not happy right now. I'm going to be honest with you. And she was like, well, we're running out of time, so we have to immediately apply the color. And I'm like, what the hell does she mean that they're running out of time? Like, maybe, you know, there's a fixed amount of time before my hair will stop accepting color after the stuff has been on. And I'm like, all right, get on with it. And I touched my head, and honestly, it felt like synthetic hair, like the kind of hair that you buy on a Halloween wig that, you know, costs $5. It, just awful. So I was like, is there any chance that you guys can deep condition this when you're done? And they're like, well, no, we're running out of time. We have to be out of here by 5 o'clock. And I'm like, okay, so you're telling me that you have to be finished with my head, no matter what it looks like, by 5 o'clock. That's not very comforting. So suddenly, three other students come and they're assisting Marcy. Like, there are four people applying, like, with little paintbrushes, all these supposed different colors on my head. Like, you know, she's like, no, no, use this one over there and use this one on the top third of her head and this one on the bottom third of her head. And I'm like, oh my God, they must know what they're doing. Like, they've got a plan. All right, this is going to work. They leave me, like, with this shit on my head. They, finally, Marcy comes and she rinses my hair. It really felt awful. Like, I felt like my scalp was going to fall off at any minute now. People, again, are, like, stopping by and talking to her. And, you know, they're asking her if she's okay. I'm like, they're asking you if you're okay? I mean, I'm the one who has to live with whatever results from this. But I guess she was having a very hard time with my head and people are hugging her and stuff. Finally, it's all rinsed out. She starts blow drying my hair, and I'm like, holy shit, it is the exact same color. It is black again. It is the exact same color that it was when I walked in here, except it's in really bad condition now. So I spent 5 hours of my day just so that she could, like, completely ruin the condition of my hair, and it's black. And then right underneath it, you know, like, as it fades, it's going to turn all these weird orangey and red colors. That's what I have to look forward to. It's like getting surgery, like someone saying, you know what, you swallowed a paperclip when you were a kid and we need to take that out of your stomach. So we're going to make an incision. And then, like, afterwards, them saying, all right, well, we got that paperclip out, but we dropped another paperclip in by accident, and this one is, like, pointy. Like, it's been stretched out and pointy, and it's going to puncture your stomach at any time. And, by the way, here's the bill. They actually wanted to bill me for this, and I refused. And then I went home, and the whole way home, all I was thinking was, like, look how healthy everyone else's hair looks. Like, the Scandinavian family, like, sat opposite me on the train, and I was looking at the condition of their wonderful virgin hair. It's all shiny and sheer and beautiful. And I was like, God, you know, it's like you notice these things when you feel like you don't have those things anymore. I was so upset that I didn't even notice that I was listening to Rush on my iPod. I don't even know how Rush got on there, 2112. All right, so that's basically what happened to me today. Please don't comment on my hair for the next few months, and let's see what happens. I'm terrified. Let's talk about Adam Wade. He is the best. He's the best guy. He is an 18-time Story Slam winner at the Moth. He's won the Grand Slam twice, so he's a 2-time champ of that. His stories have been profiled on NPR's All Things Considered. And he's been profiled in the New York Times and Time Out New York. He's also a personal friend of mine, and that makes it extra special. Without any further ado, here is Adam and me talking about mainly comedy and storytelling and some music. Enjoy. Hi, Adam.
Hello, Sherry.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me here at, should we say where we are?
Undisclosed location.
It's an undisclosed sandwich shop.
Yep, in the heart of New York City.
In the heart of Chelsea.
Yeah.
It sounds more exciting than
it is. I knew this would be the place where you said we have to location scout where should we go, and I said this place. So
good work. You know your Chelsea well.
Yeah, I do.
And
I
they're
do.
Very accommodating. They're yeah, even they're not very... playing like Hot 100 or
yeah.
whatever here.
And they sometimes they do play music here. Yeah.
I was worried about that. I was having like a little mini anxiety attack on the train on the way over.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because you'd have to ask them to turn it off.
Yeah, I was like, what if that doesn't work out? And then, of course, today is Sunday.
Yes.
And not only is it a Sunday in New York City, which means that it's impossible to find mm-hmm. any sort of place to be alone unless you're in someone's apartment, right?
Agreed.
But also, it is the gay parade today.
It is, yes, yeah.
It's an extra special gay parade today.
Yeah. It was weird how many people were celebrating the parade at Modell's outside Herald Square. I went to buy socks just now, and there was a mini parade in Modell's. So it was a lot of glitter and flags and stuff. It was quite fun. It was the most fun I've had buying socks in a long time at a Modell's.
The whole city's gone gay.
Yeah, it was very fun. A lot of people were very happy today, so it was really. It was good.
And you know what? It's a well-deserved. Like,
absolutely.
I usually hate, like, I don't like people, and I hate parades.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just, like, not a festive person. I'll be honest. I'm too socially awkward to be like, yay. But this one, I can get behind.
Yeah, it's really fun, yeah.
And also, it's for our comedy fans out there, it's mm-hmm. also the Del Close Marathon this weekend.
So we're in the midst of a lot of busyness.
Right, and it's like happening like a block away from us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised I didn't see a lot of Del Close wristbands. Did you?
Yeah, I actually did. I saw a few people because I was walking through,
Did you run into any folks?
Not that I knew, but I did see the bracelets.
Yeah. It's a fun thing. I'm like I was telling you before we started recording, I'm too old for this shit. Anyway.
You're young. You're very young at heart.
Thank you. I'm holding up, right?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Yeah. Let's just put that for the... We're both holding up great.
Yeah, we try. We get our sleep now.
So. We do. We get our sleep. We drink our fluids, and meaning water, which is...
sitting here by the mic with bottles of water.
That's right. There's no beer or anything like that. But the reason that I can say we're holding mm-hmm. up is because we have a history.
We have a big history. Let's open that box.
Let's open the box. We were both NBC pages in the same, do we call them classes?
Yeah.
We were in the same class.
Yeah.
How'd that work out for you?
I enjoyed my time as a page.
I loved it.
Yeah. It's just weird now, everybody, when you talk about page, they definitely think of Kevin,
Kenneth.
Kenneth all the time, that's the... Right. And I'm like, oh, no, it was just a year. They're like, yeah, but he was a page. And, like, you have to explain that.
Yeah, it's true. Like, people have this weird idea. I mean, it's always been, like, just to explain it to people, I think most people now kind of know what being a page is. But
yeah, he's given great,
people
know because no one knew before, so.
Well, I remember even before him or maybe just when 30 Rock started, there was that big New York Times article. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And it said the thing that people always quote back to me now, which is, it's harder to get into the NBC Page program than it is to get into Harvard.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Did you find it? Was it challenging for you?
Yeah. I mean, for me, when I moved here in 98, for the first year and a half, at least 15 months, every other Wednesday, I would go to the mezzanine and drop off a resume and a cover letter. By Robin Oakers. I'm not sure if you know Robin. I went to college with him, and Robin was the one that helped me get the first interview. So I was very, after all those.
Really?
Yeah. So
wow.
Very fortunate.
Yeah.
It was just, it was like literally every other, I worked at Virgil's Barbecue in Times Square, and on my break every Wednesday, I'd print up on my brother a word processor, a cover letter, and a resume and drop it off and hoping.
It was a huge thing for me also. I didn't have those kind of... I got in on my first try. I sent one letter. Well, actually, I did. I also hand-delivered it to the mezzanine. Yeah. I think that's a good strategy. I don't know if they would let you do that in this post-9/11 time.
Probably not. Yeah.
But yeah, I put on my best, you know, most professional outfit and took my letter up there. And
I usually have my Virgil's Barbecue t-shirt, so maybe that's why it took a year and a half.
Well, no, I mean, people say that it's really hard. And in fact, there's one page, I'm not going to name him, but did you know that he delivered flowers?
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes, I do know that story. Yeah.
That's like a charming story.
It was extremely charming.
Yeah. Yeah, he delivered flowers to the woman who coordinated the page program.
Yeah, and he got in.
Yeah, got that first interview that way.
Yeah.
I wonder if that would work nowadays.
I don't know. But it was great. Yeah,
I wish I had a better story.
It was just a really good experience, like giving tours, but no, I mean, it was an extension of college in a lot of ways, but the good thing was, is, I didn't really know anybody besides the people at Virgil's, like, in the city, so when I got the job, like, you're just exposed to some, I mean, 30 Rock, it is, like, a community entity or whatever in itself,
yeah.
So right off the bat, you meet the pages, but then you meet, like, the commissary people, the security guards, you know, it was just a very, I think Tina Fey did do a if I might give my opinion, she did a very good job, at least like dealing with several of the characters throughout the building. You know
yeah.
Because it was just a really nice community. I think that the proudest moment I had as a page was I was Steve Fastick's like page assistant, who he was like one of the heads of like the maintenance of the studios.
Uh-huh.
And I was like walking down the hall, and this was like probably like 7 months in, and people were saying hi to me and not him. It was just like, he's like, how do you know so many people? And it was just, you know, like, it's like a small town kid me or whatever, but like, I wanted to know people and I would ask everybody questions. But not Bob Benson-esque from Mad Men, but more just like I was actually like genuinely like curious, you know? And it was just nice. Like, if I didn't bring my lunch, I knew I'd get a sandwich at the commissary. Mm. You know, they'd send me in the hall. And like the security guards, if I never had my ID or, you know, it was just, yeah, I like that. I like walking into places and people knowing, hey, Adam, how are you? It made me feel important.
Yeah, I respect that a lot. I wish I could be that way. I'm really bad with names.
I am too. I just say hi, hi, hi.
That's what I would
say
do.
You say the hi, hi, hi three times.
I have to tell you one of my most embarrassing stories, actually, because I think about it, I still think about it all these years later, and I cringe. Like, I haven't stopped cringing from this, okay? So I had an assignment in Bob Wright's office.
Okay, yes.
You know, which was
the
kind of
CEO, like,
the CEO.
General Electric.
Yeah. And it was kind of like, I was really excited to have that assignment. It was like seeing a whole other world. It was on the 52nd floor.
So you take the elevator. Once you get out, it's like you're in like Blade Runner or something.
Yeah. It's an express elevator and it zips you up there. And like the doors open. And he was a patron of MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art here in New York. And he was such a high-level patron that every 6 months they would come in and do an installation of artwork, especially for him on that floor. So it was like, it was insane. White walls, white carpeting, just like nothing I'd ever seen before in my life, modern art everywhere. And he had a butler staff, a chef staff and a butler staff up there. So basically, anytime you wanted something, you just called the kitchen and you were like, hey, I'd like a cappuccino or hey, could you make me an egg white omelet or whatever? And they would just bring it to you. And everyone in the kitchen loved me. They just loved me. And I was one of those high, high, high people. And my assignment comes to an end. I'm about to start cringing even now. And it's time for me to introduce the new page who's been assigned in this. I take them into the kitchen. I could not remember anyone's name. I was like, all right, well, you guys will get to know each other. And it was so obvious to them that I hadn't learned their names, and I felt like I knew I was coming across as like some kind of bitch who'd like sort of taken advantage of them for 6 months.
I don't think that way.
God, I still feel awful about it.
I don't think feel that way.
Thank you.
But as you described all that in Bob Wright's office, I just want to indicate to the audience that we made $10 an hour as pages.
It's true, but we made a lot of overtime.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Those were pretty fat paychecks because of, like, the crazy...
Yeah.
Do you remember, did you ever work that...
like 50 hours a week.
Sometimes more.
Yeah.
Did you ever have to work that crazy Saturday Night Live schedule where you had to do, like, the first tour on Saturday morning, so it was, like, you had to be there at, like, 7:30 or 8, and then you were there till 1:30 in the morning?
Yeah.
That, I lived for that. I was like, all right.
Yeah. I mean, it was, like, looking back, I mean, it was very, like, a lot of hours, but again, it's like you wanted that so bad.
Yeah.
And when you get in and like to be part of those shows and stuff like that, it's almost like, you know, now if I watch like a rerun and it's like one when we were a page, I can just remember like where I was and like with oh, that show, I was downstairs. And,
you know, totally.
James Woods was there with the young girl. You know,
there were a few things that happened while we were there. And Cowbells, the most famous. I mean, that was like a pretty bad season, but Cowbells stands out as like
absolutely
classic.
Yeah.
Were you on the floor that night?
I'm not sure where I was. I did a lot for a lot of times. I was doing the commissary line. I would do the checking. So some nights I would do that, and then I would hang out. So I was never, I think I was only on the floor a couple times.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah.
I had like a really great position. I basically held the backstage door open.
Oh, okay. So that's a big,
So you're basically standing right there while all the cool shit is happening. And Jimmy Fallon would do like a robot dance at me to like make me feel awkward because he knew I felt uncomfortable when people paid attention to me. Stuff like that.
Yeah,
but now I'm happy.
Yeah.
Like, all right.
Fortunate.
Yeah. Do you have any like stories? You tell a great story on The Moth about your page days.
Oh yeah, I mean with the Conan O'Brien stuff.
Yeah,
they were like the best. I mean, it was just really.
Was a plum assignment.
That was the one I always wanted. The crew really adopted me. They would pick on me, but it was like a nice pick on, you know. So they would move my desks around, and they would, they did a lot of things. But
nice.
They were fun. I mean, it was like, today I live in Hoboken. I bumped into one of the guys that worked on the crew today. Like, you know, it's just nice. You know, it's a very fatherly, you know, they were a big brotherly relationship I had with a lot of them.
Right.
You know, just really, really kind guys and funny, you know.
Yeah. They're kind of like all union guys.
Yeah.
Like, it's awesome.
Yeah. And I mean, the stories, they, like, again, like, what I learned when I was a page was, like, everybody enjoys talking about their job, even if they don't like their job.
Yeah.
Like, just once they get going. And I would just say, like, you know, can you just tell me what you do or whatever? And and they would. And like, they just, like, appreciated people asking. And then after you see them again, and I would just kind of wave. And I was, like, sociable but shy. So it was, like, a weird thing. So I don't know. But, just really, 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 really interesting time, you know, for a year to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, if you can get in. I don't know how to help. Like, you know, I know it's harder to get in than Harvard or whatever, but
yeah.
I mean, it's, yeah. I'd say tenacity helps.
Tenacity, you know? Yeah. I think if they see that you really want it and you're serious and you're not there to just, like, gawk at people.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, the friendships I made there weren't with, like, celebrities. They were just with people. But it was, like, a web. I did a lot of TV production jobs after that for, like, the next 10 years. And, like, every job I got was through someone, whether it was a fellow page or a former page or, you know, sound guy or a lighting guy. It was just a really interesting. And that's why it's good not to burn bridges, too.
Yeah.
Because it was, like, everybody knows everybody. And it was just a really, you know, again, like, people later on, like, you know, teleprompter woman setting me up with their friends. I mean, it was like a really nice, you know, between dating woman and it was all fortunate that NBC page program.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell people it's the closest I'll ever get to have been in a fraternity or something.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Because you have like that experience. And then when you bump into someone like yourself, I mean, it's like we know what we went through.
Yeah. We went through a hazing.
Yeah, for a year, for $10 an hour.
True. But things have been great for you.
Yeah, fortunately. Hard work, it just seems like, you know, hard work is totally paying off.
I mean, I remember even then,
mm-hmm.
and I'll make a secret confession. I had, like, a little crush on you back in your pages.
Sure. Thank you. I'm blushing right now.
You are blushing. No, I did, because, you know, I love awkward, funny, intelligent people. I mean, that's just where I go. So, yeah, that was you.
Yeah, I definitely fit some of those criteria.
But, yeah, I mean, you were doing stand-up even then, right?
Yeah, I was trying.
Yeah, and you've sort of, like, I mean, you've just been kicking ass as a storyteller here in New York. You've won The Moth.
Yeah, like, 18 times now,
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's nice. It's definitely appreciate it.
For people who don't know the difference, because, I mean, I took a storytelling class with Margot Lightman, actually, at UCB. She's amazing. But I think that some people may not sort of understand the difference between stand-up and storytelling. Do you want to sort of explain?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for me, stand-up can be stories, too. I mean, like, you look at, like, a Bill Cosby or Woody Allen or Louis C.K., but I, you know, I don't really know what the line is where you draw. I know guys like Dan St. Germain, I mean, they and Mike Lawrence, like, they tell jokes and they tell stories too. So as far as people that are really getting established now, so I'm not sure where the line is in between. I mean, you might say in a vague sense that it's someone that just tells a story and someone just tells a joke. I mean, it's just things that you're able to do as a performer. I mean, like a Dimitri Martin or Mitch Hedberg, they tell jokes after joke. They're very talented, and I admire and I enjoy that, but I can't do that.
Right.
I mean, I'm not very good at just telling jokes, like, you know. So it's just trying to figure out what you can do, you know.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a huge appreciation for people that are able to tell jokes.
I mean, personally, I've always preferred the storytelling, like, side of that whole thing, just because I think it's a little more intimate, it's a little more personal in a lot of ways. And with the stand-up, a lot of the time it's like, I was just on the bus coming out here and this woman said this crazy thing to me, and you know that this person has told the same joke and was on the same bus. Like, I mean, he had to set it up the same way 100 times. And with storytelling, I think that before I took the class, I thought it was less scripted than it is. I know you have to, like, work it out, and there are definitely lines you have to hit and accent and everything. But it just seems like you're really getting more of an insight into the person who's telling.
Yeah, you definitely have to be more vulnerable or open.
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird thing to go through. I mean, it's separate, but it's always enjoyable for me to do stand-up shows, but mostly that are alternative shows, so you can do, you know, see how that audience likes it. Because The Moth right now pretty much had a storytelling audience are expecting stories, and stand-up shows are expecting jokes. So if you're able to kind of cross and try it and see how it goes, and you can be successful with that type of audience, for someone like me, it's very, boy, I really appreciate it. I mean, I did Hot Tub like 2 years ago in the summer.
Oh, nice.
And it was a really great show, and something that I've been working on a long time as a story. It went over well, and I just appreciated it so much. You know, the ride from Brooklyn back to Manhattan, back to Hoboken, you know, it was just something you appreciate that it went well, because, you know, that's, you always wonder, can this go over well with that type of audience? And it did, and it felt, you know, that was like one of my, you know what I mean? It really felt like you achieved something, because, you know, I hold in a high regard, you know, Kurt and Kristen. And
oh, God,
so,
yeah.
So for to do well at their show, it was, you know, made me feel really good.
I mean, I think Hot Tub is sort of like, if you get invited to do that show in this day and age, that's like almost like getting the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
It's like a big honor.
Yeah, it meant a lot. So for me, it's just, you know, preparation. Like, if you get invited to do that type of show, or get invited to do ASCAP or something like that, you know, you want to, you know, it's almost like your Super Bowl. I mean, for me, I mean, I played sports, but I was never really good. And, you know, now it's like work ethic. It's like, I'm going to be as prepared as possible. I mean, if it doesn't go well, then hey, I'm at least I put everything into it. But I'm going to be prepared. I'm going to have my buttered roll. You know, I always have like a buttered roll before a big show, because it's, you know, with just a little butter, because it's not, you know.
Does it settle your stomach?
Yeah, it's just enough to get your stomach. Yeah, I can't have like spicy, I can't have nachos or buffalo wings before a show. So you're just prepared. And, you know, through the years, just the preparation, dealing with the nerves, and like someone was telling me the other day that, like, you still get nervous. Of course. I mean, you know, how do you not? I still get small shows, I get nervous. Or whatever, there's 4 people that I'm nervous. But it's a good nervous. It's like I want to do well. I want to be prepared as possible. I'm just not going to fly by night, you know, with this type of stuff.
How many times have you done ASCAT?
I think four.
Four times.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know what ASCAT is, it's like the flagship premiere show at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, the one that the celebrities work. I mean, not that we should care about that, but it's on Sunday nights. It's two shows.
Yeah, Todd Bieber just did an amazing, like, 10-minute, like, short on like, ASCAT. It's on YouTube.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
It's really, really well done.
Oh, I'll link to that on our Tumblr. That'll explain it. But and Todd Bieber's great.
Yeah,
he's a great storyteller, too.
Yeah. He's a very multi-talented guy.
Yeah, he is. He's a great filmmaker, too.
Yes.
And a good improviser.
Yeah, and a good guy.
Even better. Even more important.
Off the chart.
Yeah. But so, at ASCAT, so basically it's like usually or you always hope that one of the UCB four, like the four founders of the Upright Citizens Brigade show up, and then like a bunch of other people show up to do improv based on a monologist's story. And you tell two, right? There's like a beginning
two
and then
a break, and then two and a break.
Yeah. How'd you like that?
Yeah, I loved it.
Was it stressful?
It was very stressful, but it's just one of those things. You're nervous the whole time, and then once you get there, I mean, they're extremely kind, like in the green room, and they're nice to you, and you know, I know, you know, the times I've done it, I've known a few people. I think Chris Gethard did it every time, and it's just like, you know, he's doing it, and he's such a good guy,
yeah.
And warm, and then he introduced me, you know, it's just, the comfort, like, I just need some type of comfort, and I think, like, Anthony and Tamanik, like, you know, they were there, like, people I know, and it helps a lot, because you're dealing with a lot, and you want to do well, you want to do as well as you possibly can, and if they're there, there's like a, There's a lot. You can take comfort. You know what I mean? You got like a shoulder to lean on.
Definitely. I mean, I think that there's probably two pressures going on when you do ASCAT, because the first one, of course, is you want people to laugh at your story, but then you also want to feel like you're giving the improvisers enough details and enough stuff to actually take off and do some improv.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And that's like just the, you know, you work on these stories and stuff, but it just throws everything into a different like reality. Like watching them do improv to a story that you told, like it's indescribable. You can't really. It's just such a high. Like,
yeah.
It really is. Like just to watch that. I think the last time I did it, someone just had a photo, and I get that photo on my. It's like me sitting in the chair, and they're acting out, and I have that at my desk, like at work, just to kind of keep myself plugging, you know, get the day job work done. But I mean, you gotta look at the, you know, I mean, that you can hardly see my face, but it's like a huge smile. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
It's like that's what I want.
God, you know, I'm with you. It's so hard. Like I think so many people can relate with this. When you're doing something that you love and you've got success at it, but you're just not at the point where you can just 100% say, this is going to support me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the danger zone where you really have to just really, I think, keep your eye on what's important and not get distracted by money and settling down.
I mean, you're talking to someone that lived in a basement apartment for 8.5 years. You know what I mean? So, you know, you got to take like every little victory. You know, I mean, the first night, and it's going to sound. First night, I had an apartment above ground, and I mean, I could look out the window and I'd see people's feet and the dogs pissing and shitting. You know what I mean? It was an amazing. So you take small things like that, and they mean a great deal. You know,
definitely.
Especially when you've worked.
Yeah.
You know, and you have $50 left in your bank account, and finally you can get your own apartment. You know, it's so you know you need the day job to an extent.
Yeah.
But you know, once my avocation can become my vocation, like my dad always uses those two words. It's like, you know, just remember what your hobbies are and what your bread and butter is, and it's a struggle, because you know you need a roof over your head. You want to be able to pursue, so to balance it. And I mean, there's been times when I've been unemployed for 2 years and just working. You get to work on your stuff, but there's this tremendous amount of guilt, because you know the $2,000 you've had saved over the years is down to like, you know, $150. So it's just that balance and that nervousness, and that's the way I am.
I'm listening to you, and I can so relate, because I've been there. I sort of look at being unemployed as just supporting the artist.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, I don't mind being on the dole.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm half English, so I think it's in my blood anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, also, if it can support me working on something,
yeah,
I'm all for it. But I understand the guilt.
Yeah.
So let's talk about music a little bit.
Yes.
We've been talking about everything but so far.
Right.
I always love to ask people this. Do you see a connection between music and comedy at all?
Yeah, I mean, as far as artistically, I'd say definitely. I mean, whenever I do writing, I mean, I'm usually listening to stuff.
So what do you listen to?
It depends. I mean, for me now, like whenever I'm writing and, you know, like, and I tell like my students this too, is like, if I'm writing something about fourth grade, I always try to like listen to something that I listened to when I was in fourth grade. So it's, you know, I mean,
nice.
So like recently there's been a lot of like, in fourth grade I listened to a lot of Roy Orbison and like Huey Lewis on the news. So there's been a lot of that lately. But it helps. It's very helpful for me getting into that mode.
Nice.
You know, like high school, if I'm writing about high school stuff, there's a lot of U2, a lot of R.E.M.
Nice.
You know, like Pixies. Mm-hmm. And there was like guys, like there was, I worked at a restaurant like 4 years in high school, and there was like the real cool guys that were like in college that worked there, and they listened to like a lot of alternative stuff. So mm-hmm. they were the ones, you know what I mean? So, and when I say really alternative, it probably was, but I mean, to me, you know, R.E.M. and the Pixies were.
They were.
Yeah.
Back
so,
then, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then on weekends, the older guys worked. So then there was like, you know, Bob Dylan and Meatloaf. So it was like a very, very different, yeah. So even now, like if I listen to like Meatloaf's "Bat Out of Hell," like it takes me back to like Saturday nights at the Puritan, where you know Jeff Conway was playing Meatloaf and telling me, you know, play this for a woman and she'll like it a lot.
Hey, let me think about that. Play Meatloaf for a woman and she'll like it.
He could have been joking.
You know what? Well, there's that classic scene in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Mm. Where the guy plays the wrong side of like the Led Zeppelin album for the girl.
Yeah.
He's playing Cashmere, which is like the least sexy song ever, although someone might disagree with me. I guess you do need some, I mean, I guess.
Yeah.
I guess that could work.
But it's definitely like that kind of stuff that gets me, you know, music definitely connects to like everything as far as what I write and stuff.
Yeah.
Especially like before a show, you're just trying to get in. I mean, I try. I didn't really take a lot of acting classes and stuff like that, so I, you know, like Stella Adler or whatever, but I mean, like, listening to stuff it helps, like, in preparation, too, like, you know, before a show, or, like, you know, if you're just taking the train in, like, what you're going to listen to.
What do you listen to, like, when you're getting pumped to, like, get on stage?
I don't know. Like, a lot of The Who. Listen to The Who.
That could do it.
Bad Company. a lot of, like, kind of, like, a lot of things that, like, wrestlers played, like, coming to the ring, kind of like that kind of stuff.
I can see that. I used to, like,
and
I also...
The Hulk Hogan theme
song. I'm kind of similar. Like, I think of myself as much more a writer than a performer.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I took a million improv classes at UCB. And when you take an improv class, you have to do a class show to graduate onto the next level. And, you know, and you begin to get used to that, and you start doing indie shows, and, you know, you get used to getting on stage. But, like, before a show, I would listen to, like, Run DMC or something.
Okay.
Something a little, maybe something that I wouldn't normally listen to at all, but I had to feel like I was getting pumped so that I could get on that stage and do it. Or some Ramones works, too.
Okay,
Ramones
yeah.
works equally well, and I love them. So, yeah.
Yeah, Joan Jett and the Blackhawks, I love rock and roll.
That would work. So you told me, you mentioned, like, while we were emailing about this, that did you DJ in college?
Yeah, I was for 4 years at Keene State College in Keene, New Hampshire. I was, I went under the name, the man they call Elvis. That was my stage name. Yeah.
Were you?
I would open the show with, Elvis from Live from Madison Square Garden.
Uh-huh.
And so it was like the 2001 theme song.
Oh, yeah.
Played by his band. And then it would be, I believe it was either CC Rider or That's All Right Mama. But it was,
because
like, I have the Aloha from Hawaii. I played that one as well. So when they would play that, and then I would come on and I would, you know, I'd say, you know, I would say something like, ladies and gentlemen, it's the man. God, I would say something like, God created the earth in 6 days, on the seventh day he rested, and on the eighth day he created Elvis. It was just really awkward, and then, like, in between, I would always, like, I'd play a couple songs, and then kind of, like, the transition, I would always play Mojo Nixon's Elvis is Everywhere. So there's, like, this whole thing.
God, that's like a good little routine there.
Yeah. Four years of that.
And every week you open the same way.
Well, I would always kind of do like an, and I want to thank, I'd be like, we have the number one show on WKNH, and I want to thank all four listeners, because there's like not a lot of people. I mean, I'm sure there were probably more than four, but I mean, you know.
Yeah.
No one gave us the respect we deserved at the radio station. There's like a lot of really, I mean, it was just when I look back, and I mean, you know, now it's like on Facebook, but you're friends with all these people. Like, a lot of them, they all had shows. I listened to all their shows.
Right.
It was just, like, one of those, I mean, this was, like, before podcasts, but, I mean, it was just, like, all the college radio shows, and it was just their personalities, too. There was, like, Leather and Lace, and if you don't listen to us, we're going to spank you. Like, I remember all of that, Inertia, and then, you know, then there was a woman that had, like, five shows. She wasn't in college, but she was part of the college radio station, uh-huh. And her name was Connie, and she was great. She was probably like in her late 40s.
Wait, how did she have a radio show if she wasn't a student?
I don't know. She might have, because it was part community. It was like the college, but also like the community could have shows.
Okay.
And she had like five shows. She had like the Foxy Mama, which was like a kind of like a blues show. And uh-huh. She'd be like, you're going to like it. And she kind of talked kind of, not dirty, but it was she had a really great voice.
Uh-huh.
And then she had like the classic alternative where she played classic movies. And then the folk Front Porch with the uncle with Aunt Connie or something. But she had like a bunch of it was just really interesting. She would have different characters. So, I just loved all those shows. You know,
college radio is great. It's a dying thing, though.
Well, I mean, it was perfect for me because you get to play, like, a lot of music. And I was extremely shy, so especially my freshman and sophomore years, it gave me an outlet.
Right.
You know, I used to go to, like, frat parties and stuff like that. And because there's nothing really else to do. And, you know, when you're not a frat guy or you're not on the soccer team, most likely you're not... You know, the girls that are at frat parties aren't going to be interested in you. And, like, on Mondays I'd have my radio show, and you just kind of talk about the parties and stuff. And it was just, you know, and I'd play, like, sad music. Because, I mean, you know, I'd fall in love with the different... I thought I was going to find, like, true love at a frat party. So
I don't think that's ever happened in the history of history.
It didn't happen for me. And I did that weekly. So I just figured... And I used to wear, like, Zit Cream, and they all had purple... Every frat had, like, a purple white, and, like...
Oh, no.
And I wore, it was, like, Retin-A Zit Cream, and... like every, like, you know, my face, it looked like a powdered donut. So it was just like, my whole face was always like, you may call me Casper.
Did you like catch sight of yourself, like your reflection in the mirror one night?
People would just say your face is all lit up. There was no mirrors. And then like, you know, and I had like a bunch of friends and like, no one had the heart to tell me. You know, I mean, I go up to girls and they'd be like, looking at me weird. I'm like, why are you looking at me so weird? You know, and there's just, so I didn't have a lot going for me.
Oh, come on!
Maybe outside. But.
You just had to learn how to cultivate your You know, your kookiness.
Yeah, and then the radio helped. You know what I mean? Because then you felt like you had a little power, like you had a voice.
Yeah,
know? And it was just, and you could be yourself. And I think that helped me as far as finding storytelling after, because it was just that was like the beginning. You know what I mean? And then I started doing open mics with the guitar and poetry and stuff. And you know, I'd have like little stories in between the songs.
That's right. You play guitar also,
yeah,
right?
Awful. Yeah,
awful,
yeah.
But So you like the Velvet Underground.
Yeah,
they're one of my very all-time favorite bands. What turned you on to them?
Again, like the guys that the restaurant I worked at in high school, it was TJ and Brian. They were a little older than me, and you know, they were the cooks, and I used to scoop ice cream.
Uh-huh.
So I was like a soda jerk, and they were in the kitchen, and they were like the cool guys. But they were the cool guys. But like usually, like in school, the cool guys really didn't like me. But they thought I was interesting, and they kind of took me under their wing. So they listened to all that, and they would always listen to Velvet Underground. Like, it was just a lot of the alternative music. I mean, I learned from them. I mean, I have an older brother, and him and I, you know, it was like Men at Work and Eddie Grant, and, you know.
So he listened to a lot of that stuff, too?
Yeah, no, my brother was more like contemporary, Daryl Hall and John Oates.
Got
and these
it.
Guys were
and, like,
listening
pop.
To yeah,
yeah,
yeah, very
the
pop.
The pop stuff,
yeah.
And, like.
So okay. Then they introduced me to, like, a lot of the bands, you know, like that.
It's funny when you say that, because, like, I'm picturing, like, these guys that are, like, they seem like the cool guys, but they're probably still in the kitchen.
Yeah. Oh, they were fooling me. No, you got me. At the time, we had like BMG Music Club or Columbia Music Club.
Oh yeah, I remember.
So I mean, I would get all the CDs like that
for a penny.
Sixteen for a penny with no more to buy ever, and then there's like asterisk, and you'd have to buy 100.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Joke's on you.
Did you ever get screwed on that?
Oh yeah.
I did.
Oh yeah. Mommy and Daddy, Wade weren't happy.
Is something scary happening behind me?
No.
Okay, because you know we're in New York City, and sometimes you could be like, "There's a woman peeing behind you."
The bathroom's on.
Oh, okay. Oh. I can't use public bathrooms. Can you?
It depends on the emergency rating of the situation I'm in.
I think it's probably for the best that the bathroom is closed.
Yes.
Is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, okay.
For the staff here, it's for the best. I've seen things.
Yes.
I've seen things.
The Velvet Underground, like listening to that type of music, it was just so different. And like, you know, like growing up, I would always dream of coming to New York. That was my thing.
Yeah.
And like hearing that music and knowing what it was attached to, like Andy Warhol in New York City, it definitely gave me, you know, an interest like in that, Lou Reed and stuff.
Yeah.
Like the first album I bought, or it was a cassette when I moved here, was Lou Reed's Street Hustle. And again, that,
nice.
Like, growing, like, the first summer, I mean, being here, listening to that over
and
over again, it was just, it gave me more, you know, this whole thing about New York City and stuff.
It's amazing. I think that the Velvet Underground basically are the soundtrack to New York City.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
I mean, you could make an argument, it's funny, because I was talking to someone recently, and I feel like the Saturday Night Live house band is also a soundtrack to New York City. Like, whenever I hear them, and I mean, there have been different iterations of them, of course, but I'm always like, that's a New York mythology kind of sound.
Yep.
But then there's also, like, to me, the Velvet Underground is like the grittier kind of thing, and I totally get that. And it does, I think, kind of like motivate people and kind of make them feel like they want to be a part of that, whatever that is.
Yeah, that dreamy type thing. And darkness, too, like, because, you know,
there's a darkness. Yeah.
But then living in Jersey for the last 15 years, I mean, a lot of Springsteen stuff, you know what I mean?
Do you like Springsteen?
Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah?
So it's just a lot, like, and I like, you know, like Darkness on the Edge of Town, like a lot of that is, that when you're living in Jersey, and I mean, fortunately, I have a lot of, I've made a lot of good friends in Jersey, so, I mean, you know, I get, like, the real tour of, you know, Jersey City.
Yeah.
You know, so it goes, that's, like, another thing. It just, like, it does click.
I'm just thinking, like, as you're saying that, of course, when we were pages, Max Weinberg was the band leader at Conan, and you had a desk assignment at Conan. I'm not going to ask.
He liked a lot of ice
hands. Did he ice his hands, really?
Yeah, 2 buckets of ice after every show.
Did you have to bring them to him?
Yes.
That's amazing.
You have to leave it in his room, his dressing room.
I'm not going to ask you your opinion of him as a human being, but I remember something that happened that wasn't too great.
I mean, I'll be honest, he was never over dramatic to me. He would just nod a lot. I mean, so yeah, fortunately or unfortunately, like, yeah, he was never like a jerk. He was
just
I think he knew
things.
Too, like, everybody liked me down there. I mean,
yeah.
And when I say that, like, the crew really appreciated me, so I don't think he, you know, as long as I got his stuff. Like, his assistant was liked me a lot, too, so, and she was very good, kind to me, so I think that helped. You know,
nice.
Yeah.
So, I told you, I was on an assignment in Bob Wright's office, and...
Dude, he came up and played the drums for Bob Wright?
He probably should have, but, okay, so, I mean, people should know this, but he's the drummer of the E Street Band, right? So, one day I was... working
and the drummer for the Max Weinberg 7.
And the drummer for the Max Weinberg 7.
And now defunct.
Yeah, right. But maybe, I mean, that might be the way that some people got to know him.
Yeah.
I mean, truly. I mean,
absolutely.
You never know.
Yeah.
I remember it was kind of shocking when, like, he agreed to, like, be Conan's drummer. It was like, whoa, you know, that's pretty amazing. But anyway, so he called the office. He called Bob Wright's office. And, like, Bruce Springsteen was doing, like, some shows in New Jersey, like, that summer. And he called Bob Wright's office, and he was like, hey, do you guys want any tickets to the show next week? Because I can get them for you. And so his assistant, Bob Wright's assistant, Anna, was like, Sherry, do you want tickets to Bruce Springsteen? Because Max Weinberg said that he can get us some. And I was like, and this is true, unfortunately, I was like, you know, I'm not the biggest Bruce Springsteen fan, but, I mean, that's, like, something I can't pass up. Like, you know, they're probably really awesome seats, and they're being offered to us by the drummer, and it's probably amazing. I was like, yeah, you know what? I will take 2 tickets. You can put me down for 2. And she was like, great. So then she, you know, got everyone else's order or whatever. She called over there. And then, like, half an hour later, she comes to me and she's like, Sherry, I'm really embarrassed to tell you this, but they're going to be $100 each ticket. He was actually offering tickets but still billing for them. And this is true.
Yeah, no, I must say that I've heard that story from a number of other people.
Is that true, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the gall.
I mean, I can confirm that other people have had that situation occur.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you don't have to kiss up to the president of a network when you're Max Weinberg, right? See, I'll just put my ass on the line. You don't
give
have
me
to.
A definition of social faux pas.
It's pretty bad. So I always like close the show by asking people 3 questions.
Sure.
And the first one, I think I know the answer to. You kind of said, kind of gave it away before, but I always ask people, kinks or who?
Oh, that's actually tough.
Really?
Yeah. I think for me, if there's no right or wrong, it goes back and forth.
Really?
Yeah. I love the Kinks.
I do too.
And I like a lot of their hard stuff. And like, this is probably not a Kinks fan thing to say, but like 2 of my favorite songs are Come Dancing, which is my opinion. And I put it on Facebook a couple of times, and I always get really like slammed. But Come Dancing is my like one of my favorite videos ever.
It's a really great, emotional video.
When he's looking down, and like and things are going away, it's just a precursor to like every.
Did you get that little lump in your throat?
And I did when I was little. Like there was something about like the big bands used to play, and then the big band would play, and then they're dancing, and then he's down there. I mean, up like looking down, it like something. And then like the other song that just like is Celluloid Heroes is like a huge song. When I was like little, I remember my mother was in Kmart like getting something, and I was like in the car. I remember the first time I heard it, I was probably like 9, and like Celluloid Heroes, and I'd never heard anything like that before. And it was just like sad and talking about old movies. And I got very, very emotional. But I like a lot of the rocking songs too.
Right.
But then the Who I do love. Yeah, that's a tough question.
I'm not gonna make you make a choice.
Yeah.
It sounds
I'd
like
say 50-50.
Like,
I'd say right down the line because it goes back and forth.
I have to tell you something though, because I've been watching like a bunch of your like in preparation for our meeting. I mean, I've been following you anyway.
Okay,
I mean, we're friends.
Yes.
We've known each other for years. But I purposely went and looked at a bunch of your videos. And one of the things that I love about your storytelling is that you have this immediacy of emotion that's like right there. And it's like you're hilariously funny, but you can also like really bring people to like the verge of tears.
Yeah.
And you've often been like very close to that when you're telling your stories. I think it's amazing that you like you can put yourself in that moment. So it just what you were saying. I'm not surprised that you like Come Dancing.
Yeah.
I'm trying to say.
And there's a story in that. You know, and a sister and it's like sad. But yeah, I just remember that video, yeah. And like I always get like like literally like once a year I'll put that on Facebook and just say once again my favorite video. And people will like slam it.
People that loved the Who from like who loved the Kinks from like way back, they didn't really like that album Give the People What They Want.
Yeah.
I happen to and I mean it says it all in the title. It's like Ray Davies was saying, you know, I'm selling out. This is here, I'm selling out.
Yeah.
Take it.
Mm-hmm.
And people did. But that being said, I really love that album. I think a lot of people who came of age.
So do it again. And he's dressed up as like a one man band in the video. Remember?
Yeah. Absolutely. So now, next question.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite TV theme song.
Can I give you a top 3?
Absolutely.
Okay, greatest American hero. Miami Vice. Miami Vice is great. I'll be honest. I'm being honest. So,
yeah.
You know, my taste is not, I'm not Picasso. Miami Vice. Because, I mean, that's the one, like, I mean.
Wait, who did Miami Vice again?
It says Jan Hammer, but I think it's Jan Hammer.
Jan Hammer, that's right. Yeah.
And then the third one, easily, 18.
Wow.
Top five.
Okay.
And that's not the top one. The top one is easily The Fall Guy with Lee Majors.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I used to sing along to that.
Yeah.
That's a great
one.
When
I wind up in the hay, it's only hay.
Wait, that's four. What would be your fifth?
Three's Company.
God. I love Three. No one's brought that one up yet.
Yeah, Three's Company, yeah.
That's a great one.
Yeah, Larry.
Oh, Larry.
Regal Beagle.
Oh, yeah. But the theme song is also good.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Isn't it funny how that show used to be considered so racy, but it's really such an innocent show when you get down to it.
Yeah, I used to love it. It used to be on, like, on Channel 56, 6 and 6:30, my brother and I, every night, you know, I was watching. We'd eat dinner, like, around 5:15, and then that, we were there.
Chrissy or Janet?
It's an interesting question. I'd say, like, growing up, it was always Chrissy.
Yeah.
But, you know, now looking back, I like Janet.
She's sensible.
Yeah.
I actually watched a few reruns recently.
She's lower maintenance. And she was, you know, with the flower. She worked at the flower shop. She was a nice girl.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, like, I didn't like her growing up. I didn't think of her as much of a, like, I didn't want to be a Janet. I wanted to be a Chrissy, although I have dark hair. But now, I look back on some of the shows, and Janet had, like, a little Joan Jett thing going on.
Yeah. And there was a little insincerity with Chrissy's laugh that it bothers me.
Oh, she's, and bad teeth. Yeah, I don't know how people accepted those teeth.
I don't know. I could accept them, I guess.
Do you remember Lana?
Yeah, Lana was hot. I like Lana.
No one ever talks about Lana.
Mr. Furley liked Lana, too.
Yeah, and she liked Jack. Anyway.
Mr. Furley was great. The Ropers are great there too.
I think I prefer the Ropers to Mr. Furley.
There was a kid in my high school, and I, when you look back, I mean, he definitely made fun of me too, but he looked just like Norman Fell. And as like a 15-year-old kid, he was a great kid. And he was like a friend of mine. I liked him. But he definitely, he definitely looked like Norman Fell.
Poor Norman Fell. Of course, Norman Fell was also in The Graduate.
Yeah, he's great in The Graduate.
See?
One of my favorite movies.
That's right, and he was good.
Talk about music with that.
Oh, forget it. The music filled out everything.
That's why it shows me, like, I was screwed up. I mean, on, like, a Friday or Saturday night, like, I used to always hang out with, like, a couple of kids, and, like, you know, we'd watch movies, and sometimes their parents would watch with us.
Uh-huh.
Like, I mean, so we weren't getting. I remember when we got The Graduate. One of my friend's father, he was like a lawyer. He's like, "Wow!" I was like, "Adam, who rented this?" I go, "Me." He goes, "Good call." I was like, "Yeah."
And you liked the music too.
Yeah,
totally. Yeah, good. And then the final question I always like to ask people is to recommend something. Like, it doesn't have to be like.
Okay.
Crazy, but...
Yeah, I'd say, like, the recommendation, you know, if you're living in New York and you're, like, have a lot of stress, what I've been listening to a lot lately is, like, Brian Eno's, like, Thursday afternoon, I've been listening to that. It's like an hour long. Like, if you're at work and you get earphones and you hate your job, not that I hate my job, I don't. And if you're stuck at an office job and you need that, just... Put your earphones on. Listen, it's like 59 minutes, but it's just very soothing. It's like a meditative thing, but it's really nice.
Is it all instrumental?
Yeah, but it's really nice.
Nice.
It's just really, for me, it feels like you're, when you go underwater and then you're listening to music, and then it's like that for like an hour.
And what's the name of it again?
It's Brian Eno, and it's Thursday afternoon.
Thursday afternoon.
You can YouTube it, but it's, put the link.
I'm going to check that out because I definitely need a stress reducer.
I put that on like a lot at work. And it's just like you know, you listen to podcasts at work, you listen to this.
Yeah.
But when I need to get this thing done in a half hour, and I'm like on the edge of my seat, and if I put that on while I'm doing it, I'm working just as fast, but I'm like relaxed.
I like that. I used to do that when I had a desk job. Yeah. You know what I used to do, actually? You know what soothed me? It's the craziest thing. I would listen to Nickelodeon audio. Like, I wouldn't watch the shows until, like, the school-age kids come home. Okay, they have, like, Nick Jr. on. And, like, all of those shows, for some reason, very, very soothing.
Well, before I found that audio, I used to listen to Carl Sagan's...
Universe?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, The Cosmos.
Wow.
Yeah.
My dad will be happy to
hear
that.
He's so subtle. It's so nice. That's very soothing.
Yeah.
He's like, this is space. This is where we come from. And it's like, oh, this is great. Yeah, it's nice.
Matt. Soothing voices.
Oh, yeah, he's great.
This is interesting because what I'm going to recommend is an album that was produced by Brian Eno.
Okay.
So there's like a little tie-in there inadvertently.
I'm trying to.
It's the first Devo album.
Oh, okay.
Are We Not Men?
Yeah.
We are Devo.
Yeah.
And like just this week, I've just been in a very Devo heavy mood.
Yeah.
And I've just been listening to that like crazy.
Brian Eno's like produced a lot.
He's produced a million people. But what's interesting is like I was reading up on this particular record and it seems that it was like a very stressful, awful situation for everyone involved. Like he had this vision of like what they should sound like and he made all these suggestions to them. And I mean, imagine this was their first record.
Yeah.
They were flown out to Los Angeles or something to like record this. And like, even then they knew what they wanted to sound like. And so every time he would suggest something, they would reject it. Reject, reject, reject. And so like he was unhappy. They were unhappy apparently. And then like, I think when the record originally came out and this was in 1978, it got very mixed reviews, and a lot of people were like, there's no, I mean, it's fun, it's wacky, but there's no heart or soul to this. It just seems very, like, insincere, I guess, was the thing. But now, like, all these years later, it's a classic.
So I guess what you're saying is sometimes going bumping heads sometimes might be good for the final product.
I mean, how do you feel as an artist? I mean, you're a one-man band, though. You can do what you like.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want, but sometimes, you know, if it's the right person you want, I'm happy to listen to. You know what I mean? If it's for direction, and sometimes you just need it, you know, just to get out of your norm.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I agree. But you know what? I have to say, though.
There's got to be trust. But
yeah, there has to be trust. And, like, one of the things you learn, like, when you're doing improv classes and all that, the first thing you learn is, like, you have to learn how to listen to notes.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just be like, well, I think I was convincing tortoise who knows how to read the encyclopedia, you know, or whatever. But then again, you do have to ultimately trust your gut.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Devo didn't want to change, or they believed in what they were doing so sincerely. And look, it worked out for them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there you go. Anyway. Well, listen, Adam, and you, do you want to like plug anything?
I do.
And you can also email me and tell me.
Yeah.
Like, you.
Well, I have my Tales of the Cosmos show will be, I believe it's Friday, July 19th.
Okay.
And that's at 7:30 at UCB East. And then I have the Adam Wade from New Hampshire show. It's the second Monday of every month at the Theater Under St. Mark's at 7 o'clock.
Cool. I'm going to actually, like, say all this at the beginning. So I'm just going to say, Adam, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Such a pleasure.
Really, it was a great, great, great talk.
All right. Off you go.
Well, there you have it. My talk with the wonderful Adam Wade. Again, I said I was going to plug his shows at the beginning, but I'm just going to repeat them here. He's got two shows coming up. Tales of the Cosmos on Friday, July 19th at UCB East. That's on the Lower East Side. And he has a monthly show called the Adam Wade from New Hampshire Show. And it's the second Monday of every month at the Under St. Mark's Theater. I want to thank Adam again. I also want to thank Mina, Thomas, Lauren, and Alex. And again, you guys know what you've done. I'm trying to keep this short. Follow us on Twitter at LTB_podcast. That's our awful handle. Like us on Facebook. And also follow us or just check us out on Tumblr, Louder Than Bombs Podcast at Tumblr, where I'll be putting up lots of cool stuff that we talked about tonight, including stuff about AskCat and other assorted fun things. That's all for now. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Next time, we're going to have the wonderful Zubin Parang, who is a writer at The Daily Show. So you'll want to tune in for that. And I'm really sorry about the audio. I've got to work on my audio skills. They suck. But until then, I'll be seeing you around with my awful hair. Bye.